Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On today's show, we are talking about trade policies and tariffs. The Trump administration has imposed tariffs of 25% on steel and 10% on aluminum. The administration has threatened to start a trade war with China. What does that mean exactly? And it has pulled out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. So today we're going to talk about very basic things. First, how are trade deals made in a globalized world? How are tariffs set? And how will these changes affect workers and the economy? Today, we are joined by Susan Aronson, research professor of international affairs at George Washington University. Susan Aronson is also a GWU cross-disciplinary fellow and senior fellow at the Center for International Governance Innovation. Hi, Susan. Welcome to the show.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. Thank you for coming on today. We're also joined by Lori Wallach, Director of Global Trade Watch at the nonprofit consumer advocacy organization Public Citizen. Lori Wallach is also the founder and a board member of the Citizens Trade Campaign, a U.S. national coalition of consumer, labor, environmental, family, farm, and civil rights organizations and groups. Hi, Lori. Welcome back to the show. Nice to have you.
Hello.
Well, it's great to have both of you. Can we start off by talking about the basics? When we look at the global economy, I mean, things are so globalized now. If you look at the iPhone, it's a great example because the materials are found and bought and taken from a certain country. They're sent to another country to be assembled, and then they're sent to the U.S. I mean, sometimes many, many countries are involved in making an item. So in this globalized world, Lori, how are trade deals actually set?
So there's sort of two sets of issues. There are what are the trade rules, and then what are the actual practices of different countries. So there are global rules for trade set through a body called the World Trade Organization. And part of the rules there are actually about trade, so cutting border taxes, which are called tariffs, and opening quotas, which are limits on how much stuff would be sold in a country. And that agreement is the successor to a thing called GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, that also is about trade rules. Now, in the WTO and in regional agreements like NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, a whole other agenda got super glued on. These agreements get negotiated behind closed doors. In the U.S., which has a disproportionate role in setting the agenda, there's 600 official corporate trade advisors. Mm-hmm. And as a result, these agreements that were supposed to be about trade got hijacked by these interests. And they now have in them, for instance, in NAFTA, rules that make it easier and cheaper to outsource American jobs. Rules that give new rights for foreign corporations to attack our laws outside our courts in front of three private sector attorneys and demand taxpayer compensation for laws they claim violate their NAFTA rules. Hmm. Rules that limit food safety. Rules that actually, contrary to free trade, create monopolies for pharmaceutical companies to expand their patents and raise medicine prices. And all of those rules, some of which are fine, getting rid of the tariffs, some of which are outrageous, promoting outsourcing. Hell, there are even rules in NAFTA that limit how our tax dollars can get used. You can't apply Buy America, Buy Local rules when we spend when our governments spend our tax dollars. We have to treat foreign-made goods the same as local ones. All this garbage got grafted on. So those are the rules. Right now, NAFTA is being renegotiated. Some of that outrageous stuff is actually coming out for interesting reasons we can discuss. Mm. Then there's what actually happens. And the practices frequently of some countries don't follow the rule. And then you end up with a situation we have now where there are trade enforcement actions. And that's where these tariffs that everyone's talking about have come in. Those are basically penalties aimed mainly at China's behavior, which simply is ignoring the rules of the World Trade Organization that China signed up to. So that's the overview.
Well, and that is a great overview. And we'll talk specifically about things like what happens behind closed doors, the 600 official corporate trade advisors. When the Obama administration was really pushing hard for the TPP, which, Lori, your group says is NAFTA on steroids. We learned a lot about what was going on behind closed doors, but it was difficult to get that information. Susan Aronson, what would you add to this very basic question about how trade deals are made, trade rules are made? What would you add to Lori's explanation?
Well, first of all, Lori, nice to speak with you and nice to speak with your audience. I see this rather differently. It's not as if, I do agree with Lori that the system of rules has not always worked in the interests of average Americans, and really, I don't blame trade agreements as much as I blame really bad domestic policies in the United States. So that's where Lori and I part company. Lori and I do also agree that the process of making trade policy has seriously broken down, and in particular has really broken down under Trump, where, you know, I think basically the Trump administration has totally ignored how the advisory process is supposed to work and who's supposed to advise the administration on trade. They've pretty much ignored Congress, and they only listen to business, and yet they only listen to some businesses. For example, I can tell you that a lot of digital businesses feel totally ignored because the Trump administration focuses so much on industries such as steel and aluminum that really don't have a trade problem but do have an overcapacity problem and a product substitution problem. But in direct response to your question, I start from a different paradigm. And that is, when I teach my students about trade, and this semester I'm totally rethinking what I teach and how I teach it. But when I talk about trade agreements, I talk about these agreements as ways to improve the rule of law among countries as to how and when nations can put in policies that can distort trade. And those policies can be anything from a tariff, as Lori suggested, but they can also be domestic regulations, such as privacy policies or policies regarding how drugs are produced and priced. And I would say that to a great extent, the spillover effect of some of these trade agreements has been to reduce the leverage of some countries in terms of regulating in ways that it's not that their regulations have been changed, but they could be challenged for how they regulate in a trade dispute. And I still feel that the system can be improved, but I feel that the Trump administration is undermining the rule of law embedded in the system. And so I really am very upset by what's happened under Trump. And moreover, if I could, and I believe you want to do this later, I'd like to talk about how the Trump administration has misused trade policy to address the problems of the steel industry or the problems of workers, instead of encouraging unionization and investing in worker retraining, et cetera.
Okay, yes, we'll definitely talk about that. But let's talk about the point of disagreement between the two of you. Again, Lori Wallach is director of Global Trade Watch at Public Citizen, and Susan Aronson is research professor of international affairs at George Washington University. So, Susan, you said that you agree that the rules have not worked for average Americans, and
Hold on. I did say that, but I want to say this. Look, at any one minute, we are many things, right? I'm a parent. I'm a taxpayer. I'm a consumer. I'm a shareholder investing for my children's college and my retirement. So, simultaneously, I may be both a beneficiary from trade agreements and a loser. And so I think it's a very, very complex. But workers tend to, and, you know, people, there's just, the New York Times just reported on a really interesting study, which was talking about why people feel that they are mainly a loser. And they tend to look at problems from the perspective of how they can protect their sunk cost rather than the potential benefit from it. So if I could just reevaluate what I said, and I apologize for being rude to you, it's just that it's not black and white. And that doesn't mean trade agreements can't be reformed and improved, but I believe in trade agreements. Trade agreements are agreements to build trust and to give voice. So when the United States signs an agreement such as NAFTA, okay, it is an agreement that allows us to challenge regulations in Mexico and Canada as much as Mexican Canadians to, you know, if there's a trade spillover, to challenge regulations in the United States.
Well, let's talk about this, because, Lori, I mean, I just was looking at some new books that are coming out, and there's new books still coming out about the effect that NAFTA has had on jobs in the United States and in Mexico. So, Lori, what does the data tell us about how workers have been affected by trade policies? And if you can be as specific as possible, that would be great.
You bet. So here's the thing. Trade itself is a potential benefit in that we can get a greater variety of goods, we can specialize in things we're good at. The question under dispute is trade under what rules? And we've had this set of rules that were written by and for those special interests, the 600 corporate advisors, who, for instance, you know, made a subjective choice. They were going to put protections that were useful for them that made it easier and cheaper to outsource jobs. Folks who want to look up Chapter 11 of the NAFTA, you can get the NAFTA text by Googling it. It's a whole set of rights and privileges for companies that outsource, and the right to raid federal treasuries if they're not treated in a privileged way. So what's happened? We went from having a small trade surplus with Mexico before NAFTA and a small trade deficit with Canada, to having last year a combined $177 billion goods trade deficit. If you add in the services, where we have a surplus, we're still in the hole, $150 billion. There are 960,000 certified jobs by the U.S. government just under one narrow program as lost to NAFTA. That program only covers certain subset of jobs. That's an undercount. On that list, there are 171,000 and change jobs from California alone certified under this narrow program as lost to NAFTA. If you look more broadly and look at our bilateral agreement that was the condition for China to join the World Trade Organization, some of the proponents of that agreement have done a study called the China Shock that says we lost 2 to 3 million American jobs under that trade regime. Now, how does it affect you if you haven't lost your job? And by the way, for folks who want to actually see where these job losses are or who want to verify what I'm saying, you can go to our website. Under a Standing Freedom of Information Act lawsuit settlement, we have the entire database of all those government-certified jobs. And unlike the Department of Labor's database, you could search ours by your zip code, congressional district, the sector, the company name. It's all at tradewatch.org, www.tradewatch.org, and go right in the landing page to the Trade Data Center. There you can also see, by the way, 30 years of every congressperson's vote on trade. You can look at your own state, California's, outcomes. There's a two-pager on what's happened with NAFTA. Because also California's major exports, that before NAFTA you had a surplus in the major products California exports to Mexico and Canada. You now have a deficit. All of that info is there. But the bigger picture I just want to close on in this question is, if you yourself haven't lost a job to trade, you've still been affected by these rigged rules. It doesn't have to be this way. We can do better. Because when all of those higher-waged manufacturing, they largely are manufacturing jobs, are sent offshore, the Department of Labor shows that 2 out of 5 of those manufacturing workers, when they get rehired, lose wages. And of that percentage, the 40%, a quarter of them lose up to 30% of their wages, which is a cut of over $7,000 for the median wage. This now means, and actually is sort of the grandfather of macroeconomic trade theory, Professor Samuelson mathematically proved some years ago, shortly before he passed away, that the loss in wages across the economy, because when those manufacturing workers then go look for a new job, they're now adding to the workers competing for the non-outsourceable service sector jobs, which means even in sectors where job numbers are growing, lots of these kind of jobs, wages are staying flat. That's the effect of outsourcing across the economy as wages stay lower. And as a result, Professor Samuelson was able to show that the benefits we all get from imported goods, lower prices, because, you know, trade benefits are supposed to be on the import side. It seems counterintuitive, but that's the theory. And it makes sense. Some people lose their jobs. We all get cheaper stuff. But now the wage losses suffered by Americans is greater than the gains we get from access to cheaper stuff on net. And this is the indication that our trade agreements and policies need to be rewritten so that we can harvest the benefits of trade in a way that's distributed to more people, not just the big companies who wrote the rules and are maximizing profits, but to most of our detriment. Hmm.
Lori Wallach is Director of Global Trade Watch at Public Citizen. Susan Aronson is Research Professor of International Affairs at George Washington University. Today we are talking about trade and tariffs. And if you'd like to join us, if you have any questions about trade policies, how they are written, who makes the decisions, who is benefiting, who are the winners and the losers, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. As Susan says, this is not black and white, but we have seen major, major changes in terms of wages, the kinds of jobs that people can get. You know, I think it's also important to talk about the wages that people are making overseas who make things that we buy on a regular basis. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Also, if you have any comments about the tariffs, if you work in an industry that uses materials or goods targeted by these tariffs, what changes have you seen? Susan, how would you respond to Lori's last point about the fact that wages have gone down? Yes, stuff is cheap, but when you look at how much people are making, I mean, as you know, so many people are really struggling just to make ends meet in this country. And some of these people have 2 to 3 jobs.
Absolutely. And, you know, I guess I think Lori is blaming trade for a phenomenon that's much broader. Unfortunately, I would blame instead policy ineptitude and a total unwillingness on the, you know, I mean, one of the things that makes me so distraught is that in terms of U.S. policy is like this Congress is totally ignoring what we should be doing to help people adjust to a changing economy. If we can't deal with changes to steel and aluminum, which are not trade problems, they're, like I said, overcapacity and product substitution problems. There's too much steel making in the world, and companies are using a lot less steel, and people are buying goods with a lot less steel. But if we can't deal with that, and protectionism is the response to deal with steel, what are we going to do about 3D printing, AI, smart factories, et cetera, which are going to totally change the job mix? Mm. And so, to me, what we need to be doing, we're going to have to do, is find ways to help workers adapt and also find ways to move workers into areas where they can find job fulfillment, but also find good-paying jobs. And there's going to be a lot of people, as always historically has been, who are going to get hurt, who have been hurt by technological change, and the job of government should be to help them adjust to that change, because that change is inevitable. We can't stop it, but what we can do is provide a different and more effective social compact to help them. I do object to the characterization of trade as only being about benefits in terms of imports. I see this differently. And part of this is because, as Lori knows, I wrote my dissertation on the history of something that never came into existence. It was called the International Trade Organization. And the idea was, during the Great Depression, as more and more people lost jobs, the depression wasn't caused by trade policy, but it was furthered, if you will. Unemployment was furthered by protectionist trade policy. And before I wrote my dissertation, I worked for a congressional agency on steel. And I went to a ton of steel towns around the United States and spoke to steel unions and companies, executives at companies. And here's what I found. We never hold companies responsible for the protection that they get as to what they do with the benefits from protected time, whether they get higher prices due to tariffs, because they don't realize the actual benefits of the tariff, but they're protected during that period. So, you know, they suffer from less foreign competition. So do they reinvest in worker skills? Do they reinvest in plant and equipment? Or do they use that time to and money to buy back their shareholders or to increase dividends? And that's what they did. So protectionism, to me, is an off-budget strategy by governments that has nothing to do with actually solving the problems that might be caused by trade or might be caused by technological change. It's an ineffective solution. The reason we have trade agreements is not just to establish the rule of law in trade, right? What are going to be the rules by which firms and individuals can trade? It's also to delineate how and when nations can put in place policies that can distort markets. And those can range from using cybersecurity rules to privacy rules to subsidization, et cetera. And I believe very strongly that we need to work harder to find the rule of law in trade. But we also need to look at our own government, which has failed us miserably in terms of helping people adapt to changing markets. And sometimes that's due to trade, and more often it's due to technological change. That doesn't mean it's any more or less painful for the workers, but we really must invest more in people.
Lori, I know we have to let you go. Brief response to Susan, if you can just wrap it up by saying, you know, what changes to trade would you like to see? And then what are your thoughts about Susan's comment that we need to adjust to this rapidly changing economy? Did we lose Lori? Did Lori hang up?
Sorry, I'm here.
Oh, okay.
Here.
Lori, if I know we have to let you go, but can you just respond to what Susan said?
And yep, I heard you.
Okay, great.
So there is no way to compensate our way out of the reality we are in under these current rules of trade and globalization. We have a system that is so severely rigged by the special interests who got to write the rules that the majority are the losers. A compensation only works if most people benefit, and then you compensate those who are being hurt. And I am all for, by the way, more job training, more investment. But the reality is, under the current rules, there is no way to fix the race to the bottom in wages, to fix the endemic imbalances in the global economy. We have to have new rules. So I think it's worth just noting what's happening right now on NAFTA renegotiations, because it's counterintuitive. The guy who is the trade ambassador for the Trump administration is, as very progressive U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown says, the only good cabinet official in this administration. He is a guy who basically has been focused on U.S. manufacturing, U.S. workers, and he has an agenda to redo NAFTA that overlaps about 70% with where progressive Democrats in Congress, where consumer groups like mine, Public Citizen, labor unions, where the faith groups and the environmental groups have been. And that involves, number one, taking out the incentives at the heart of NAFTA to outsource jobs, taking the rigged part out. So getting rid of those, well, you've basically got agreement to get out of NAFTA, the outrageous investor state dispute settlement system, the system with the tribunals attacking laws and making it cheaper to outsource. He is adamant to get rid of the buy local, buy America ban that requires now that when the government buys stuff, instead of how it was for decades and decades, they're supposed to buy stuff made in America and reinvest the money here. And that's, for instance, GE, all those billions of our tax dollars they got, they had to work, they had to have American workers until NAFTA, when they could relocate it all to Mexico. And by the way, wages in Mexico are now lower than they were before NAFTA started. They are now on par with China. They are in industrial areas, $1.50, $1.80 an hour.
Wow.
And this race to the bottom agenda also has been pursued by a total lack of labor standards. So even though it seems totally counterintuitive, this trade negotiator is actually working with the U.S. unions, who themselves are working with the Mexican unions, and they are fighting to try and replace this model of race to the bottom by having real enforceable labor standards, so that workers in Mexico have some chance to actually negotiate to get better wages. And then they're insisting that there be a sunset clause added to NAFTA to impose some democratic accountability. And that is a clause that says, if trade stays out of balance, if the jobs continue to go, because we're outsourcing more jobs to those low wages, American brand name companies, basically treating a Mexican worker in the same fancy robotic plant, car companies, aerospace, computer, super plants, that are the exact ones in the U.S., where the U.S. worker gets $20-$25 an hour, the Mexican worker gets less than $2 an hour, equally skilled workers able to do the same thing, no floor in that competition, unfair to the Mexican worker, unfair to the U.S. worker. The idea is, if you replace those rules, you create a new paradigm, a new model for trade agreements that can show a successful alternative to the race to the bottom model, and make North America and the new agreement a model for the kind of trade agreements that can get the benefits of expanded trade without the race to the bottom. Now, obviously, there are a lot of people in the Trump administration who would rather dine on ground glass than get rid of these corporate rights and add labor standards. So there's a huge battle inside the administration about this. What's super interesting is that Democratic members of Congress have basically made clear, if you guys want to do an agreement that delivers what we've been asking for forever, then we're happy to, of course, see that implemented. Can you get any of the Republicans in Congress to actually support that and implement that? If that got done, and by the way, the tariffs would stay zero. There's no tariff increasing here. It's what rules, what incentives, where's the investment going to go? What are the wage levels going to be? What are the rules under which companies are getting signals? Are they the rigged rules that we've had, or is it a new take? That's the big fight. And we may know as soon as the middle of August whether or not that new deal could be negotiated. Similarly, on these tariffs, so there are big downsides to these tariffs because other countries are reacting to the U.S. tariffs. But the tariffs are happening under two trade enforcement actions that actually go to trade cheating. And this is where Susan and I disagree, because the steel issue is a trade issue. The steel is being overproduced in China using subsidies. China this month is the third month in a row of production maximum capacity, which is to say the largest flow. Even during the financial crisis, when no one was buying steel, Chinese production continued to grow. It's subsidized. It's a strategy of the government to keep people employed and try and keep social peace. The government pays for it. The products get dumped in the market. Up until now, there's been a lot of meetings about global oversupply of steel. Other countries have put up tariffs to keep the stuff out. Europe, Canada, etc. The U.S. joined the party. We've been basically in a trade war. However, we haven't done much about it. The rest of the world is now reacting to the U.S. also saying, hey, we don't want that crap either. The point of it is to try and get a signal sent to the Chinese government that is, you can put your money into buying, to making these steel plants and making all the steel. You're going to have to chuck it into the ocean because no one's going to buy it, including now the U.S. I mean, the U.S. has a trade deficit that is multiple billions larger than any other country, because we've just been willing to absorb that excess capacity for years and years. Now, the way these tariffs have been implemented, because tariffs are a tool. You know, if someone's not following the rules, this is the enforcement. You say, okay, you're not following the rules, you can't sell it here. That's what that tool is about. The problem is the way the administration did this was chaotic, half-assed, non-strategic, and borderline lunatic, which is, as compared to getting all of the countries together, who should be allies, who've been subject to this kind of trade cheating, and saying, hey, let's all make clear to the Chinese government, they can't keep doing that. That's hurting everyone. Instead, in a sort of haphazard way, the sequencing of one enforcement and the targeting of countries was done such that, for instance, Canada or Europe ended up subject to one set of tariffs and other countries to another set of tariffs. Some countries negotiated, Brazil, Australia, Korea, and they don't have any tariffs. The chaos in all of this means that while there are real problems that need to be addressed that are enforcement issues, the way we've gone about it has not been strategic, and now all the focus is on the counter tariffs, which is we put in those tariffs to stop the flood of certain products that are unfairly produced, and now other countries are mad at us, and they're sanctioning our stuff, and the coverage has not been about the real job loss, the real problems relating to the underlying problem that's being enforced against. They're just coverage about the blowback. So it's a big honking mess, and the way to avoid that, like for instance in the first instance, is to get the rules right, which is why I'm focusing my time on getting that NAFTA replacement right. And if folks want to know more about that, there's a website called replacenafta.org, www.replacenafta.org, that lets people know what's going on, what the demands are, puts in one place all the different letters. There are hundreds of law professors who are calling for NAFTA to be replaced by taking those corporate rights out. There are hundreds of small businesses who have basically joined that model, unions, environmental groups, faith groups. The Catholic bishops have even gotten in on it. So www.replacenafta.org.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us, Lori. And I know we have to let you go, and you stayed with us over time. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Lori Wallach is director of Global Trade Watch at the nonprofit consumer advocacy organization Public Citizen. Coming up after the break, we'll continue speaking with Susan Aronson, research professor of international affairs at George Washington University, and we'll be joined by Celeste Drake, trade and globalization policy specialist at the AFL-CIO. On today's Your Call, we are talking about trade policies and tariffs and how they affect workers and the economy. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation about whether it's possible to change the corporate wing of the Democratic Party from within. A lot of people are asking that question in light of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's victory against Joe Crowley, a 10-term establishment Democrat in New York. A number of people across the country are now running on a very progressive platform. But the question is, how will the corporate Democrats respond to all of this? What are your thoughts? That's tomorrow. Friday, it is our media roundtable. We will be talking about the ongoing immigration crisis. We'll talk about what's happening with the separation of children from their families. And we will also talk about the meeting between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin. Today, we are talking about trade policies and tariffs. And if you have any questions or comments for our guests, that these are very big topics, but any questions, how trade policies are met, how they affect workers, if you've been affected by the tariff changes we've seen, we'd love to hear from you, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we're joined by Susan Aronson, research professor of international affairs at George Washington University. Now I would like to welcome Celeste Drake to the show. Celeste is the trade and globalization policy specialist at the AFL-CIO, where she advocates for reforms to trade policy on behalf of working families. Hi, Celeste. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. You know, I'm glad we have an hour to talk about this, because this is not an issue that we can spend just 5 minutes on or a soundbite. And we've been talking with Lori Wallach of Public Citizen and Susan Aronson just about the role that trade plays and how it affects where we are right now. The you know, obviously a race to the bottom here and definitely overseas. We're at a point where 40% of Americans cannot afford a $500 emergency. We do so many shows about people having 2 to 3 jobs. Celeste, as someone who works for the AFL-CIO, what role do you think trade plays in all of this?
Well, unfortunately, and I'm not sure if you've talked about this already, but the United States, for as large as our economy is, trade is a smaller proportion of our economy than most other countries. So we hear all this sometimes about, well, why do you complain about the negative impacts of trade because it's a small part of our economy, and why aren't you talking about automation and some of these other things? And here's what it comes down to, is that trade agreements and our trade policies are about much more than just trade. It's much more than just the movement of goods and services across borders, and that's why they have an outsized influence, because what they do is sort of set this box around our economic policies by saying, these are the kinds of regulations that are out of bounds, these are the kinds of things you can't do to prop up your economy, these are the limitations. And because of that outside influence and that sort of trying to lock down against more progressive economic policies, you can actually put a lot of things that are happening in our economy with wage stagnation, with growing inequality, with the rise and outside influence of corporate power at the feet of these very trade agreements that lock in those kinds of mechanisms.
Mm. What about those mechanisms, Susan?
Well, hi, Celeste, and again, hi, audience. I actually disagree a little bit on that. I have to point to U.S. policy, which gave corporations the voice of citizens, most recently and unfortunately with the Citizens United decision. So that's one thing, and that to me is a lot of the reason why we have such inept, or Congress is so unwilling to really address the problems of many Americans. But trade agreements are not written by and for corporations. Yes, many corporations, and now many others, do attend the negotiations, but they're not in the room. Congress tells the executive what they can negotiate, sets the objectives, etc. I'm not excusing it. As Lori said, and she's absolutely right, the bulk of advisors are corporations. There's only one committee that includes unions. Well, that's not true. There's two, but there's only one, and that would be the main Trade Policy Advisory Committee does have some union members, or at least it did until Trump came in. I don't think they even consult those groups anymore. The whole process of trade policymaking has become much less accountable and transparent, and the steel tariffs would be an example of that. When all of a sudden, the President of the United States said, in disagreement with the Secretary of Defense, that the problems of steel and aluminum are national security problems, and therefore, it's okay for us to put in place tariffs on our allies, including allies that have no army, like Costa Rica, and allies that fought aside U.S. soldiers in every war since World War I, such as Canada. There's something that if I could just add one other comment. I do the human rights impact assessments for the EU. So I look at each EU trade agreement, and believe me, they are signing a lot these days, including yesterday's signature on EU-Japan. And they don't have binding language on labor rights. But there is one thing that they do that the United States does not do, and it'll be good to hear Celeste's thoughts and your audience's thoughts. They, in general, put a lot of money on capacity building, and they help to invest in civil society as well as labor unions, and they help the government. They try to help to empower and bring attention to labor unions in trade partner countries. I'm not saying they do it better, and the evidence, by the way, shows that of all countries, the United States does more than any other country to improve labor rights. But I am totally in agreement with Lori and Celeste that we don't do it right, and we need to do it differently, and we need to do more.
What changes specifically would you like to see on that front, Susan, when it comes to labor rights in these deals?
It's... First of all, what is truly shocking is that we do very little to directly empower workers at the factory floor level or at the working place level. Like many people don't work in factories. People are not educated as to what their rights are under the law. And it's very, you know, to me, it's not just about what you do on the supply side of governance, but it's also what you do to help workers change their situation, to empower them. And it's very difficult to do that in trade agreements, but I think we should start that process. We need to involve people more in trade agreements so they understand what they're about and that they feel they have a part in determining it. Like right now, their influence is indirect.
No, it's okay. Do you want to finish that thought?
Well, so I was speaking more broadly about how they can be improved. But in terms of empowering workers, it's not that the language isn't correct. It's just that there's very little incentives to change those cultures because there's a lot of corruption in those countries. So the government agencies that are supposed to monitor labor rights, those people can often be bought out by factory owners and other people who employ workers instead of actually enforcing the laws. So it's not so much what is written in the trade agreement that is the problem. It's to a great extent that there are other governance problems. So if we can do more to help make labor rights a priority, to show that countries that have better labor rights tend to have investment that moves towards higher skills and pays higher wages, those kind of things. If we can, in every factory and workplace, have ways of educating people about what their rights are under the law and how they can challenge violations and who they need to go to see and how they can make those violations more transparent, I think that'll help a lot.
Celeste, what would you add?
So I think, you know, some of what Susan was saying I agree with, and I think some of it actually makes my point about what trade agreements do. So if we're talking about how workers on the factory floor are not empowered, and we're talking about how ministries of labor in the countries that we trade with, particularly developing countries, aren't really empowered and are sometimes paid off not to inspect or not to find problems when they do inspect, that's actually one of the things that our trade agreements do that's a problem. You know, it does contain labor language. It's largely been form over substance, but they do have provisions called investor to state dispute settlement, where the foreign investor that comes into the country doesn't just have, you know, a petition right like the workers do. What they have is the right to bring a government to a private tribunal to sue over any change in any law, any regulation, any judicial decision, any administrative decision, any government proclamation that they claim jeopardizes their current or future profits. And it's exactly that power that often prevents a Ministry of Labor from getting its job done, because they will come in, these countries are looking for that investment, they're looking for that job creation, and they get that foreign investment. And sometimes part of the deal is, you know, by the way, don't send your labor inspectors here. By the way, we are going to rely on you to keep unions out of this workplace, because we want to keep wages low, because we don't want to have complaints about workplace safety. And, you know, the same goes for the environment. If they want to put effluents into the water, if they want to put toxins into the land, all of these things. And that's all enabled by the FTA that includes this very great privilege for foreign investors. So we're setting up a situation where you have already disempowered, impoverished workers and already, you know, powerful capital, and we're making capital even more important. And I think there is, you know, but what I do agree with on Susan is that, you know, we do need to invest. I think the United States has taken an approach that trade is somehow development policy in itself. We no longer need to do aid. All we need to do is trade, and that somehow magically workers will gain workplace freedoms and rights, and that somehow countries will become more democratic and more equal, and all of these things sort of just come naturally with wealth, when in fact they don't. Mm-hmm. And all of that takes some space for civil society to become empowered, and for institutions like labor unions and NGOs to really say, no, we have rights here, we're going to fight for better, we're going to fight for more equal distribution of power, of resources, all of these things. And when we're doing trade agreements with sometimes very repressive regimes, and we're just putting this nod to labor rights and environmental protections, but we're not including technical capacity funding, we're not including, you know, truly effective enforcement mechanisms that guarantee that these rights won't just be written down on paper, but will be enforced, that's important. And one of the problems is the vagueness of the standards. The words do need to change, because just saying the words freedom of association, which means right to join a union, that doesn't tell you specifically, does an employer get to force an employee to watch an anti-union film? Does if that's happening, is that consistent with freedom of association? We just don't have a lot of clarity. We don't have a lot of effort to monitor. We don't have a lot of effort to actually enforce. And the one labor case that's ever come up under a U.S. free trade agreement was a massive failure. It was the U.S. challenging Guatemala for its practices, and the only real enforceable obligation there was enforce your own labor laws. And somehow the U.S. managed to lose that case. And a lot of it comes down to the language of that agreement, the Central America Free Trade Agreement, which said, had all this, you know, weasel words. Well, if you don't enforce your laws effectively, you have to also show that it was in a manner affecting trade, and it was sustained or recurring course of action or inaction. And the panel went through and ticked off all these things and basically said the U.S. didn't come up to snuff because of all these weasel words. So there's a lot more that we can do to protect labor and the environment, but there's a lot more that we can do to really rebalance the power and level the playing field and get trade agreements out of the business of telling countries this is the way that you cannot regulate financial services, and these are ways that you cannot regulate food safety, and these are ways that you cannot label your goods. I mean, those are all questions that society should make in a democratic manner and be able to say this is what we want to do because it's right for our people and our country. And as long as companies are saying, no, you can't do those things because there are trade barriers, what we're doing is we're making people feel that trade agreements disempower them and interfere with democracy. And that's a big problem.
We have a question from a listener about wages. We're almost out of time, but let's hear from William in Belvedere. Hi, William. Welcome to the show.
Yes. My perspective is that if in one country people are receiving 3 crusts a day to produce an item, that the same item is produced in another country for 2 crusts of bread a day, no one in world trade is going to pay 3 crusts of bread a day for something they can get for two crusts of bread a day. And that's kind of like a force of gravity. The lower the wages, the work goes there, the work leaves the places where the wages are higher. Mm.
Well, again, this is a point that we need to talk about, and we don't have that much time, but Lori mentioned in Mexico, the wages are about $1.50 an hour. There's a Nike factory in Indonesia where mostly women are working 12-hour days, and they're making 83 cents an hour. So what about that point, Susan?
No, I totally agree, and I agree with Celeste that investor state provisions, they do not belong in trade agreements, that investors, they're supposed to be state to state, not investor to state. And the dispute settle, we need to help investors find ways to settle disputes. And in the past, the way that that was done was investors would bring it to the state to bring a trade dispute. But the EU has suggested some reforms regarding investment, that this needs to be done internationally, and we need to do it differently. And I don't want to take a lot of time on this, but I totally agree with Celeste that these things are undermining support for trade agreements. They've been in trade agreements since NAFTA, they should not be there.
And Celeste, how would you answer that question? I mean, when you look at the wages overseas, you know, we're talking about the lack of rights in the United States. If you look at women in Indonesia, I mean, they have zero rights, and they're working for 83 cents an hour, working for Nike, whose CEO makes about $47 million a year, Mark Parker.
Right. So I think the caller really hit, you know, the nail on the head with that question is, you know, wages are going to tend to fall down to the lowest common denominator, and that's been our experience, you know, since NAFTA. You know, workers who are lucky enough in the United States to have a union, when they go into bargaining, are constantly being told or implied by the other side, don't ask for too much, or please take these concessions, you know, actual cuts to their wages and benefits, or else we'll move overseas because we can pay, you know, workers in Vietnam 69 cents an hour or things of this nature. So, you know, unions are one way to fight that. If there were real free and independent unions in that operating across Malaysia, Vietnam, in Mexico, in China, some of these places, they could help, you know, bring wages up. But we also have to say that, you know, one of the problems with trade agreements is they, as they're currently written, they look through this lens of economic efficiency only. And they don't really give a lens to human rights, free speech, free association, the right to collectively bargain. And if we're strictly looking at economic efficiency only, the logic of that is going to drive wages ever down and ever down and ever down. And what we found in the United States, even if folks are able to point to something that's cheaper due to imports, what we're facing is all those other costs, housing, education, healthcare, rising and rising and rising until the end. When you look at real wages, many workers in the U.S. are in fact worse off. And so you can't just point to, well, you're able to get some cheap socks from China, so who cares if there's not a sock factory in Tennessee anymore? I mean,
well, we're going to have to continue this conversation. Unfortunately, we are out of time. Celeste Drake is Trade and Globalization Policy Specialist at the AFL-CIO, and Susan Aronson is Research Professor of International Affairs at George Washington. Thank you both for joining us, and thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.
Thank you.
Thanks for having
us. Good day.